I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels. And
welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
On the chance that you'll meet and you meet.
Laura Macy with us, the author of Project Reunion, It's All About Me. Laura's of Italian origin, earned a BA, a degree from William Peterson University of New Jersey, as a double major in art and theater. Her very first role was the role of Gretel in the musical Hansel and Gretel in the fourth grade. And by the time she was 16, she'd model eye makeup and hair, and besides live performances on NBC, ABC Talk, and magazine news shows, she was doing an awful lot. You know, as a matter of fact, if I, Laura, give everybody your total background, we're going to be here for an hour, and I love every bit of it. How are you?
Oh, I'm wonderful. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. You've had a heck of a background, huh?
Yeah, I don't know what it is. I'm here alone with my cat.
I don't know what that is. Cats are good. By the way, the book in and of itself, the Project Reunion, It's All About Me. When you decided to go to a reunion, or when we hear about a reunion, if we have a year away, does it cause us to really think about who we are, why we are, how we look, and that presentation that you want to make when you see people that you haven't seen for 20, 30, 40, 50 years, whatever the case may be? What was it that stimulated you to put this book to pen?
Well, you know what? It was almost like a double dog dare, because I had never been to a reunion before. And my best friend, with whom I went all through school, grade school, high school, college. Anyway, we went to high school together, obviously, then. And she said, we're invited to the reunion. You've got to go. I said, absolutely not. Didn't like the people when I was there. I was 2 years younger than everybody. I was always the twerp. I said, no, I'm not going. And she said, you have to. Please, come on. The two of us will go. If we don't like it, we'll leave. I said, okay. But I'll only go if every day until the reunion, which was 326 days before we had this conversation, I said, we do something proactive so that we'd be like, hey, look at me now. I want to be the prettiest. I want to be the richest. I want to be the thinnest. I want to be the most successful. And she laughed. But I found that a lot of people, not to sound corny or, you know, slangy, but a lot of people stress the reunion. A lot of people, the longer they're out of high school, the longer they're away and they don't go to the reunions, the more apprehensive they are. And they're doubting themselves many people are divorced, or they've had failed businesses, or their children are driving them insane or to the poorhouse. And they look back on their lives at this age and say, oh, why would I go back there? What am I going to say? You know, my son's in jail. What am I going to do? And sure. Which, of course, was not the case. But the thing is, what I did then with the book was try to say, okay, look, that glass is not half empty. If I have to blow bubbles through a silly straw, that glass is going to be half full. And we are the absolute best, whoever. We are the prettiest. We're the richest. So what it is was almost like a call for people to have self-esteem, to look at your day, just look at your average every day, and make it the best it is. For instance, at one point I paid for my niece's violin lessons, my granddaughter's dancing lessons, somebody else's music lessons. I mean, it was a crazy day of writing checks for all of these lessons. And I thought about it, and I thought, now, I could say, eeks, I'm broke until next week. I can't go to the union broke. Or I could say, I am going to be buried with philanthropist on my tombstone because I'm a patron of the arts. So is it a little silly, maybe? Did I stretch it? Oh, yes. But I think if people had that, you know, I'm not a psychologist, but I think if people had a more positive image of themselves and realized they are the best, there would be a lot less apprehension about these things, or about anything, really.
Sure, Laura. I remember when I went to my 10th reunion, And in my 10th reunion, everybody was cool. Everybody was showing everybody else how wonderful they became, etc. Then I went to the 20th. And the 20th, everybody had kind of settled down a little bit. They were still had that little bit about, look what I did in my life. Now, I missed that. Here comes the big one. We won't tell anybody about this number. This is our secret. Okay. Then it was the 50th, okay? And I missed the 50th. Ooh. But they sent me a bunch of pictures, and I took a look at everybody, and I thought, my goodness, what happened to us? I mean, you know, we went from young kids scrapping and dating and having fun mm-hmm. to there were people in wheelchairs and people being helped out to to the dance floor. Yeah. And it was almost as mm-hmm. if, you know, thank God that I lived this long and got here, and I am who I am. Mm-hmm. And so I think mm-hmm. a reunion for everybody is a really good thing because you get to learn something about what drives you.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, and that's what happened to us, to Gail and myself, my best friend that I mentioned in it. You know, we realized, we thought, you know, we're pretty cool. And the people that intimidated us, because as I said, I was a real weenie, the people that intimidated me because they were like the, what would you call that? There was a movie, the bad girl, the real cool mean girls, that's it, the mean girls, or the so-called, you know, really hot football players and all of that. You want to know what? They were overweight. They were flabby. They were bald. You know, half of them were unemployed. And I'm thinking, And I came from an affluent town. And I'm thinking,
Yeah.
And even the girls, I mean, some of them did not know that the 60s, that the hippies are from the past. No offense to the hippies. But, I mean, there were some girls that needed mirrors, and I thought, and I was afraid because of this. I mean, I had my agent pick my outfit because I was so insecure. You know, I brought 3 or 4 outfits to my agent, and I said, okay, Jim, which one should I wear? And he laughed. He said, Laura, you're kidding, right? He said, half of these girls probably are still using Tidy Bowl. What's wrong with you? I said, well, I want to look the best.
But Laura, you know, the other thing that happened, what I forgot to mention was I did go 1962 when Summer 60 turned. How old was that? Radio Susie, how old was that? 60. How can you say that and have a straight face? When Summer 60 turned 60, I went to that one. And it was very interesting because we were having fun. In those days, you know, we had car clubs. And some of the guys that were there from the car club and, you know, we got together, we're standing in the hotel of the lobby. And as people were walking in, we're saying, who am I? Who are you? Nobody recognized each other.
Exactly. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
yes.
We're spending
the star time of our old school production that I used to drool over. And I thought he was the greatest looking guy. I did not recognize him until he walked up to me. I mean, really.
There was a girl that I woman then in 62. I was absolutely in love when I was in about the 11th grade. This woman, when she broke up with me, broke my heart. Oh, there was never going to be anybody like her again. This was it for me. And I saw her, and I looked up at the sky, and I said, thank you, God.
There you go. That's the song, Unanswered Prayers. God knew what he was doing.
Yeah, but see, really, when it comes down to it, I think, you know, the Project Reunion, it's all about me. I wonder how many people read the book. I think people should, because it'll bring so much out for you. You really get to take a look at yourself, either resonate with it or not. But the key is, I wonder what goes through all of those minds for all those people who know they're going to go to a reunion within a year, and then it's coming. Now you got to look good.
True. It does. It does. I've talked to even, I mean, I did it as, of course, a very egomaniacal female, but I have talked to men. I remember sitting across the table from a man about it, and he said, you know, I was nervous about going to my reunion, about one girl that he happened to like, about a time that he got caught cutting school, and I don't know, his car broke down in like an unmentionable place. And he said, I don't know if I can go. I just don't know, you know. And I'm like, of course you can. And it's amazing how people, it does touch a lot of people in different ways. I mean, a bad appearance or even losing weight. I mean, I'm silly about the way I tried to lose weight, you know, counting donut holes instead of whole boxes of donuts and things of that sort, you know. But it does make people think and realize that, yeah, maybe I can do this, you know.
Yeah.
I don't,
There was a woman who wasn't there. You know how some of those instances that stay in your memory that were there? And I'll never forget this. I'm in the 12th grade. We're sitting in my car. She's breaking up with me, right? That's two of them now. She's breaking up with me, and she's telling me she met an older man. Now, he was 18, and he was just starting college, right? And she said, you'll never be. Yeah, I know. The older man. And she said, you'll never be the man that he is. Now, as a 16-year-old kid, I can kick his rear end, yada, yada, not understanding truly what being a man is. And you go back, you think those thoughts, and you smile, and you wonder how you would have reacted if you would have been who you are today and gone through everything you've gone through. Very interesting.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's that old cliche, if I knew then what I know now.
Oh, absolutely.
Laura, let me ask you this. We're
starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at where we can get the book and find out more?
Yes. My website is www.lauramacy.com, LauraMacy.com. And if you click onto that, you can get onto my blogs, which I have a definitely quirky way of looking at life. You can get onto my blogs, my tweets. I'm on Facebook. So I'm Laura Macy, author on Facebook, or Laura Macy. And the book can be gotten through the website or through barnesandnoble.com or amazon.com. And I'm also LinkedIn somehow. So if you look for me, usually I say absolutely yes. And I'd be happy to give you any more information. I think that covers it.
Yeah. Hey, Laura, thank you so much for joining us. It's been fun, and everybody should go to their, we won't tell anybody about the 50th reunion thing here. We'll forget the number. But everybody should go to their 20th, their 30th, and their 50th reunion and bring who they were plus who they are, and what a difference it would be in those times. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me. Thank you very much.
Okay, good night.
Such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places. Mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is. So why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice. Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. You want to join us? 888-429-5471. That's 888-429-5471. Jeff Wilson with us. He's the author of Life's Cheat Sheet, Crucial Success Habits, Habit school never taught you. Boy, is that not the truth. Jeff has run, owned companies, filling in the roles of CFO, COO, CEO, legal counsel, and the turnaround guy, helping those companies reach record sales and profits. He's taught at colleges, and he's given estate and financial planning seminars. He holds a JD and MBA and MHCA. I said, Jeff, if I do this whole thing, how did you ever have time to go into business with all the degrees?
I'm a little hyperactive, so I tend to go to school at night.
No, by the way, I love every second of it. By the way, when you really come down to it, in the economy today, and we have, you know, it's such confusing messages that everybody's getting out there. Most people are frightened to death. And if you really look at the economy in and of itself, there are still people that have the wherewithal, that have the roadmap, quote unquote, of how to do things and move through those challenges and roadblocks. We still are a country for the entrepreneur, for the business. We still can be successful if we get beyond. And I'm going to ask you the what that is. What is that missing link that you found in most companies that, that caused them not to get where they want to be?
Well, a lot of this is really designed toward the person who either works in a company or for themselves to, you see, I honed in on negotiation, and a lot of times people's minds set themselves up for failure before they even start. So that's really the first stage I try to get past, is get people to get out of their comfort zone and go ahead and I guess the mindset is really where I start, is that you realize when you're going to negotiate for anything, you didn't have it to begin with, so you're not going to lose something. You're only going to gain from it usually. And so you just have to ask and you know, do the planning like I've noted in there, the five components to have success a lot of times in different things you're going for.
Now, by the way, I would say success has got to be a mindset, but there's something else. In academia, there is so much information that you can get, you can be taught, but it really doesn't come out until you get out in the street and actually put everything to the test. That's where the wisdom comes in, and that's what I heard you just say. What the book is about is not the academics, it's the wisdom. It's the how to get out there and get it done.
Definitely. It's street smart skills based entirely, and that's why I'm not taking shots at schools to say they didn't teach something. They have to follow federal and state guidelines and all that to prep for colleges and other things. And you can see from the contents that I've shared with you, the skills and the subjects that I cover in there are typically not subjects anywhere taught in a scholastic environment.
And by the way, when you're walking into a real retail store today, or even if it's not brick and mortar, everything seems to be, and I use your word because it's very powerful, it seems to be negotiable, because the price tag is the price tag. It does not mean that it's not going to go for something less than that. And most people are frightened to death to even ask if they can get it for a better price, or know how to ask to be able to get it for a better price.
Right. Definitely true, and that's why I say I start with mindset, because I've worked with a lot of people, and I actually had one guy that I remember was a really intelligent guy, educated, but he was petrified to try to negotiate anything, to get, like you said, a lower price or something, and we actually had him go into a 7-Eleven one night and go up to the counter and ask the lady, where can I find a 7-Eleven? And he was petrified. He had to get way out of his comfort zone. He thought he was going to get yelled at, made to feel stupid and everything. The lady said, you know, you're in one now. What can I do for you?
Yeah.
And it just gave him such relief of that petrified feeling that he was going to be, you know, yelled out of the store and everything. And it's getting past that mindset originally and realizing, again, that you didn't start with something, so you potentially are only going to gain from it. And you've got to go, you know, sort of prep your mind like you saw in the steps, but also you've got to step up and ask.
Sure. Now, by the way, when we talk about that, we're living in a society today, better yet, a culture which is a facet of the society. Jeff, we're living in a culture today that everything is basically laid out for everybody, and there's entitlement. I mean, we can go on and on with this. And because of that, people are almost frightened to ask for something if they don't just get it. And I think a lot of this in what we're talking about here should be taught starting in the junior high schools or the middle schools and then brought up to the high schools and then from there. You know, this kind of information does not get taught in the schools today, which is really surprising why we wouldn't prepare our kids to get out and be something once there wasn't somebody there, quote unquote, holding your hand and telling you how to learn it. And I think that's the key. We've gotten to a situation where if you're not high tech, where are you going to go anymore? There's no wood shop, there's no metal shop, there's no water shop, and there's none of those things that were practical that people could put to use. This would be a practical, put-to-use kind of class.
That's exactly what I've put it together for, and in hopes that in time it will make its way into curriculum. But I'm also speaking in different high schools, and I'm going to hit the college market pretty heavy because that's really it's written at a simple enough level to make certain that folks just graduating and getting out of school can get that head start that many others are not going to get, because you're going to come out, like we said, without that from a scholastic environment. And if you can get these skills ingrained in you at that young level, you don't have to take the next 10, 15, 20 years and stumble and, you know, trial and error things to learn these things like many of us have done. And that's really the purpose of this, was I said, let's grab 25 years of trial and error, put it back there into simple enough language and understanding that folks in their upper teens and 20s can pick this up and get a head start of most anybody else their age.
Jeff, there's a word out there, and that word is called no. Most people are frightened to death of the word because they feel like it's a personal rejection, but it isn't. All no means is, for the most part, not right now. And we can take the definition
right.
of the word. Yeah. Yeah.
That is That's definitely, it. I actually use the, anytime you hear no, you think next.
Yeah.
And there's another phrase we use a lot of times that I've liked. I think I've got it from Jack Canfield, one of the chicken soup guys. I remember it as Sam Walton, but SW to the fourth. Some will, some won't, so what, someone else is waiting. And so it's a mindset that says, let's move on. If you get that no, you move forward.
Yeah, and by the way, no is okay, because what happens with most people, you say no to me, and all of a sudden we're going back to the rejection here, and I walk out, I'm depressed, I'm whatever, and I validated that I can't get anything done. But whoever said no to me would have said no to anybody in that similar situation, in that condition, asking the same thing. That's what they don't get. There's a lot, the only
exactly.
power... Yeah, the only power no has is what
it's
you give.
It's taken personally, usually. It's taken like as a personal defeat for you personally, and rather than just a generic, that's what would have happened anyhow. What I've told, I had a number of people do, is we have a huge, it's like a flea market craft area just west of here, and it's all vendors and crafts people out in the outside, basically, in several acres. And I have people go there that are scared of this and just go up and make offers. Because you got all of these craftspeople and vendors, a lot of times flea market kinds of folks, wholesalers, they're used to that. And so you get a lot of no's in there, but it gets you toned for accepting no.
No, absolutely. I think it's a great exercise. And one of the things that I've learned over the years, basically, is this. If you have a brick-and-mortar store, or if somebody's calling you, whatever your mode of reaching your target audience is that, excuse me, when it comes down to it, if they're coming to you, one of two things are going to happen. You either sell it to them or you talk them out of it. And people they don't recognize that. And people talk themselves out of things all day long. And it's even on the other side of it. If you want to negotiate, you want to buy something, don't talk yourself out of it.
Right, right. It helps to do some background, like you've seen in there, and come up with your leverage points on either side, if you're the buyer or the seller. And I can switch gears pretty easily. I've dealt with a lot of cars, for instance, and I like to do that. I've had other people ask me to do it for them purely because I have done it a lot, and you can come up with a lot of leverage points and a lot of, if you ever heard the acronym BATNA, which is best alternative to a negotiated agreement. It's your backup plan, your plan B. And you have a couple, three plan Bs. So if it doesn't go your way or it goes south, what are the other options that are as good or close to as good that you're going to take if you have to walk away from the deal?
No, by the way,
if you plan those things ahead of time. Go ahead.
And I was going to say, Jeff, and if you've got that kind of ammunition, quote unquote, it's the old adage: you don't take a knife to a gunfight; you fight fire with fire. So you bring you bring along what you need in your bag of tools. I won't say ammunition. Well, maybe your bag of ammunition, and then you work with mm-hmm. that. Most people don't have. They don't have the ammo, quote unquote, and they've got the proverbial knife in a gunfight, and they're going to lose.
Right. And usually they try to wing it, unfortunately, and that puts more pressure on them if they're already hesitant. They're under a lot of stress then. And if you do this background and do some research, get your leverage points and these BATNAs, and even if you get some objective criteria, like in a car purchase, go to NADA.com or Edwards or something and get some similar values and go to AutoTrader.com and Cars.com and get all those where I think AutoTrader has 2 million cars out there. Get the ones that are like what you're looking for and the values and the features and stuff so you have objective criteria you can use in your negotiation as potential leverage. And then you sort of design in your mind a little offer, concession, counteroffer kind of strategy from best to worst. And the baton is sort of if it doesn't work, we're moving on to the other thing. We're going to walk.
Sure. And by the way, what we're talking about is knowing what you say, knowing what you're going to say intentionally, and what you say and how you say it will have a predetermined reaction or some kind of an outcome. And I really believe if somebody walks in prepared like that, they're going to get what they want, and everybody ends up happy. When you get what you want, does not mean that the other guy loses, quote unquote. Negotiation. Everybody comes out on a level playing field, and everybody gets what they want.
Right. I try to shoot for the win-win, and typically it is that. I was just in Las Vegas recently, and I had a nephew that's in his low to mid-20s with me, and they had a problem with their rental car. I had gotten them a pretty good deal on a car and had a problem with it, and I said, I smell an upgrade. And he didn't know what I was talking about, but he knows I do this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I happen to be a travel agent on the side, so I know how to work that some, and worked with the guy, and he stood there and listened. He came out, and he said, oh, my gosh, I can't believe it. Because I got him a convertible, this and that, and no money. And he said, oh, my gosh. And you were so nice to him, and he was he liked that, and he did it for you. And so there was a win-win there. They kept this customer. He's going to go back to them because they took care of him.
Sure.
He saw how I could work that to get him an upgrade, and that guy got another car for us and got another car rented. So, I mean, there's wins all over there. Nobody lost there.
That's the whole key. You know, if you know what you're doing ahead of time and the people who are negotiating with you recognize that you do know what you're doing, there's a respect that underlies the entire thing. Now, Jeff, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at, buy the book at?
Sure. The best main site is Life's Cheat Sheets, plural, because it's set up as a series, sort of like the Chicken Soup series, but I have the second one, Crucial Financial Habits, School Never Taught You, already drafted, and then there's a couple others backing it up.
Wonderful. Hey, Jeff Wilson, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Sure. You can also follow me on any of the typical social media and Jeff Wilson Today. I appreciate it. Thanks a lot for the time.
Take care, Jeff. Good night.
Yep. Bye now.
Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous, faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. We'll be right back.
There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. You want to join us? 888-429-5471. Stephanie Marone with us. She's the author of What Animals Taught Me, Stories of Love and Healing from a Farm Animal Sanctuary. She's the author of 9 books, including The Natural Medicine Guide to Bipolar Disorder, The Natural Medicine Guide to Autism, The Natural Medicine Guide for First Aid Remedies, and along with her writing, she runs a farm animal sanctuary, an energy medicine practice for animals that grew out of years of helping animals on her farm, and she helped them to heal from a wide variety of illnesses. Stephanie, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, Stephanie, what I've learned about animals over the years is if anybody doesn't think animals think, they better take a long look at what life is really about. They respond, they think, they have emotions, they cry, they get angry, depressed. And if those aren't human traits, I don't know what are.
Yeah, it still amazes me that we're kind of at animal 101 in saying, oh, yes, they have feelings. But anybody that, like you, who has spent time with animals knows that that's very basic, and yes, of course they do.
Yeah, my sister has a dog who has, the dog's got, he's got problems with people leaving him, all right? Separation anxiety, okay? And if you put a jacket on, the dog is barking all over the place. If I'm 2 rooms away, if I get my keys, he starts barking. If I say I'm going out, he starts barking. So it's almost as if he understands the language and he knows exactly what you're going to do.
Well, this is amazing you bring this up because Rupert Sheldrake, I don't know if you're aware of his work, he's the PhD biologist from the UK. He's done all this work on animals that know when their people are coming home long before they hear the car or there's any other indication, long before the people in the house know when the other people are coming home. And there's some telepathic connection that connects us all. He refers to it. He's coined the phrase morphic resonance to describe how our energy fields are connected. And so you probably don't even have to jingle the keys. You could just think about leaving, and that dog would know it, probably.
Absolutely. It's mind-boggling to watch him. There are 4 cats and 3 dogs running around here. Each one of the dogs is about 100 pounds. It's a sanctuary in and of itself. And everybody gets along, so that works really well. But the point of contention is to watch the interaction. Dogs, cats, etc., they're all family. They walk over each other. You know, they'll do a little snapping once in a while. But for the most part, there's this line of respect, and you can see who leads, who doesn't. I get up in the morning, I walk out, and everybody starts migrating into the kitchen, and they stand in line. They go to where they get fed.
I love it that you bring up the word respect because that is the complete message of my book and of the Animal Messenger Sanctuary, which is my farm animal sanctuary. The message from the animals and in this whole setup is respect for all beings. And it's quite remarkable how much better relationships can be when they're based on that. And I'm talking about relationships between humans and animals, but also, of course, between humans. And
sure.
The animals are such good teachers in that way. Because there's no, people talk about a hierarchy and how there's an alpha dog and there's a lead mayor. They don't have any ego involvement in being that leader. It's the one who's the best at it, and it's the one who's going to do the best for the group. So it's really amazing to watch humans do this projection onto animals that, oh, they're manipulative or, oh, they just want to be in charge. But in actuality, they're making a very wise decision in who they decide needs to be the leader.
And they also know how to absolutely control you. I just found this out about two or three days ago. The one dog, if you touch him by his rear end and his tail, he gets kind of snarly and snappy. So when I really brush him and get rid of all the junk, because he got really the hair up around his rear end and stuff was hanging on there. So I'd have to put a muzzle on him, and my sister would hold him, and he'd snarl, and it was just like vicious. Now you take the muzzle off, and he's sweet again. So we took him over to the vet to get cleaned up, and we walked into the vet's office. He gets in, jumps on the scale, right, and then we walk into the room. Now, I'm waiting for snarling and snapping and, you know, get the muzzle on. Nothing. He sat there as quiet as you could be. 3 days ago, she took him to the groomers, who shaved him completely. No muzzle. He gets back here, he knows how to run the place.
Well, I guess that would be your fault, Michael.
Absolutely. I take full responsibility. Maybe I should feed him more than twice a week. What the heck? But it's true.
I think the message in that also is that every behavior has its wisdom to it, and people the first thing I thought of when you said that was, I wonder if he has some kind of spinal sensitivity, but I guess that's not it, huh?
No, but that's what we would have thought in the very beginning, but it was all these knots and everything is around his rear end.
Well, it's sort of like girls with when they're about 8 with long hair and they don't want their hair combed because it hurts.
Yeah.
Maybe it's like that. Anyway, I'm so thrilled that you're such an animal lover. That's wonderful.
Oh, absolutely. But the one thing I did learn when the dog came back from the groomers, which you wouldn't even recognize him, I looked at him and I said, how do you spell the word con? Because he runs this place. I just realized it. Now all of a sudden the behavior has changed. Alpha dog takes over again. That's
well,
me.
You know, I had to learn that. I had to learn that from my miniature horse Pegasus, which she's small enough that I really could control her if I chose to use the method of control rather than cooperation. But yeah. She really had me wrapped around her little pearly hoof shortly after she arrived. I was not a horsewoman. I didn't know horse language. I hadn't been through Horse 101, and I really learned from her that I actually brought someone in who's. I guess you'd call her a kind of horse whisperer. She was someone that she really is like a counselor for relationships with horses. And she came in and she just told me straight out, she watched us for a little while and she said, Pegasus is the boss here, and the reason why is that you're giving her no signals whatsoever that you know how to lead.
Yeah.
So I had to learn horse language.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and I really believe in and of itself is a language, which all has to do, obviously, with connection with the animals. That's really what we're talking about here. And if you don't know the language and you don't know how to connect, you're in trouble. And that's where the problem is. And if you want to know what somebody's like, see what they're like around animals and if they have animals. I met a woman probably, 10 years ago or so, and we liked each other. But she did not like animals, and she basically said, you're going to have to get rid of the animals. Well, I say goodbye to her, and for that, there was a reason for that. If I could do that to her, if I could do that to the animals, what could I do to her?
Yeah, that's such a good point, because to me, it's really about having an open heart. And if you would ask someone to get rid of their family members, what does that say?
Absolutely. And again, I'm going to go back to connection. And that's really what we're talking about, what they have ended up teaching us. Not what we've taught them, what they were teaching us. Let me tell you a quick story, and then we'll go right to the book. About 8 years ago, 10 years ago, 10 years ago, I got divorced, and I had, you know, a dog and I had a couple of cats. And then a couple months later, somebody said to me, boy, have I got a dog for you. And I said, well, okay, bring her over. So she turned out to be, and she still is, she's a shepherd, and she was abused. And I hadn't realized it till I got her. And what would happen, I was sitting alone in the house, you know, night after night, I'm working with the computer. And if I would get mad at the computer, I'd get a little loud with it, and she'd cower and go out the dog door. So I had to learn to hold the temper, quote unquote, so I wouldn't upset her. And one thing led to the other, you know, and to this day, years ago, I put a foot up by her and she'd cower. She doesn't do it today. But the point is what she taught me a very valuable lesson. It was kind of control yourself. You do not have to be yelling at something.
That's wonderful. And you in turn taught her to be able to trust you.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. She's the only, I have one problem with that dog today, that somebody comes in here, they look at her, they want to steal her. She gives you those eyes. Done.
I guess you better watch out.
So we can all learn. And I really believe if anybody's listening tonight, sit down and take some notes. You know, what have you learned from your dog? What have you learned from your cat? How were you before you got the dog? What happened in your life that caused you to think of something differently? Because how you treat those animals will be how you'll treat your family and your friends.
And, you know, one of the biggest lessons that I learned, Michael, was to look at each individual animal as both as the species of which they're a member and also as an individual animal. But the species is very important because there are certain needs that different species have that a lot of people tend to plow over, where they just make the animal fit into their life. A simple example of this is a border collie for a dog. We'll just talk about dogs since people are living most closely with dogs. Border collies need a ton of exercise, and if you don't get them a ton of exercise, behavior problems are going to start to arise, and then people say, well, what's wrong with this dog? And it's the same with a group like sheep, which is, they're very close to my heart. I have sheep on my sanctuary, and I've learned so much from them, and one of the big lessons there is to let them be who they are, not who you decide they should be or who you have thought that sheep are. I think people look at sheep and, you know, it's reflected in our language, the idea of mindless followers, sheep, mindless followers. Well, sheep are really good at cooperating as a group. They can move as a group like a school of fish does. How do they do that? It's remarkable because they're moving without touching, and yet they move in perfect synchrony with each other. And I look at that and I say, wow, humans could really learn a lot about how to cooperate with each other in this way. And we tend to dismiss sheep as stupid or mindless followers when actually they have a wealth to teach us.
Oh, absolutely. And I look at the competitiveness. You know, when there's a cookie or a dog biscuit or something around, they get competitive. But for the most part, they don't care. Just as long as I'm comfortable, as long as I can go out, as long as I can do this, they're not in competition with you. And I think there's where the real problem is, that the animals don't think that they have a problem and show it socially. They just live this. This is who they are. Accept me for who I am, or quote unquote, don't. And that's the way I think humans should be.
Yeah, and also they're very present, aren't they? There's nothing quite so present as a dog or a cat or a sheep or a horse or a donkey.
No, right now.
And then the other piece in there that I'm sure you've learned if you've had animals for many years is how much they miss each other when one of them dies.
Yeah.
And how much they miss one that leaves. And it's beautiful to see that connection.
Oh, yeah. I had a friend of mine years ago. I had two dogs, and he fed them together. And one of the dogs had passed away, and the bowls were out there. He would put the food in both bowls, and the one dog would eat out of his bowl. He would never touch the food in the other bowl. That was for that one dog. And I've also found,
talk
which
about
is, yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, I was going to say, talk about respect.
Yeah. And what I've noticed also, too, with animals that are close to each other, if there's only two, if one goes, the other one may not be around that much longer.
Yeah, yes, it's really true. I've had that happen. I tell the story of this in my book with two of my sheep. One was the son of the other. And the mother was quite elderly, and she finally, her body just gave out and she died. And he was a perfectly healthy sheep. He stopped eating, and I knew that he was taking himself out, and it took him 9 days, and he left within 9 days.
Yeah.
I was absolutely amazed. I'd never seen anything like this.
Yeah, but let's take you back. Where was it where with the sanctuary, with the rest of it, when you took a look at it, at animals, and you saw them in that different way? Where was that for you that started this entire thing?
Well, First, I want to say that I believe that we all come in with this incredible connection between ourselves and nature, and that those of us who are lucky manage to keep that connection all through our lives. I was fortunate in that I had a tender-hearted mother who modeled for me, who nurtured that connection in me, that natural connection, and also modeled for me respect and love toward animals. So I got some extra help in holding on to this. I think I came in with a huge connection, an unusual kind of connection maybe. It's always been very strong, but I lived in the city, one city or another, for many years. It was when I came back to the city, and it came back to the country, because I grew up in the country. I moved back to the country, and animals just started showing up. It was quite amazing. The one who I really have to say took us into the formation of the sanctuary was Pegasus, the miniature horse. There was already a wild desert donkey that I was taking care of, but he belonged to someone else at the time. But it's when I rescued this miniature horse. She was on a tether. I could see her from my office where I was working. I'm a writer, sitting there writing at my computer, looking out the window and seeing this little white horse on a tether, round and round. She could hardly go anywhere. The rope would get wrapped around the pole. For those who don't know, a tether, it's just a little short spike stuck in the ground with a rope tied to it and the horse on the other end of the rope. She would kick over her water bucket. I couldn't stand it. After a few days of this, I went down to the neighbor to find out what the story was and to find out would they perhaps want her to come to a good home, because I was living on 8 fenced acres. It was a very safe place for animals. And they said, yes, actually they did. And so I brought her back, and that was the beginning. And then she had a condition called foundering, which is the rich spring grass produces this very painful hoof condition, and she couldn't be free grazing on the green grass, but the vet said, well, if you got some sheep, you could keep the grass down for her. So it was kind of like the house that Jack built. Then I got some sheep. I rescued some sheep, and one of them arrived pregnant, so then it went on from there. And I want to make a point, though, of saying that my farm animal sanctuary, as other farm animal sanctuaries that I know of, the animals are, the males at least, are neutered, so there's not a growing population on the sanctuary, because we're all about rescuing animals that need a home, not in bringing more animals into the world.
Yeah, and by the way, I'm a lot like you. Well, let me tell you what's dangerous for people like us. You're standing someplace and somebody said, isn't that a cute elephant? I wonder if he's got a place to live.
Oh, don't I know it. They do. I tell you, when I moved to the country, I hadn't been there more than 2 days when a wildcat showed up. And this wildcat showed up and, you know, was dying. So I nursed the cat back to health, and then it's been one arrival after another.
Yeah, no, I've been that way for I don't know how many years now. There's always, you know, a ton of animals that float in. And thank goodness I'm in the Milwaukee area now. I was in the interior of Alaska for 20-some-odd years. I had horses up there. And, you know, and let me tell you what, at 8, 9 o'clock in the morning at 50 below zero in January, it is not fun to go feed and clean and make sure their water's hot.
You can tell you are devoted if you were willing to do that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a world. But I don't think it's something that is innate with people. I think it's a learned response. You have to have the like, but then as you grow, I didn't really have animals till I was 18, 19 years old. So realistically, I think if they pick up your book, they start to read it, they make a connection, they recognize something within the book that they see themselves with, then all of a sudden it's a different story. Because there's a lot of babies out there that need help and need a home, and they deserve it. And how anybody could be cruel in my heart of hearts and in my life, I have no idea how anybody could do that stuff.
I know. And I try to stay away from the cruel stories, because I mean, we've all read enough of them. We have enough of those images in our head, perhaps, that I really try to focus on where it goes from there. So some of my animals, I just briefly put in what some of the backgrounds are, because they didn't come from good places, and I don't tend to dwell on that, but I think it's important for people to realize that if they don't know already, that this is definitely going on. And one of the reasons why I have a farm animal sanctuary as opposed to, say, a dog or cat sanctuary is first because there are a lot of people who are working on behalf of dogs and cats, But second, because a lot of people don't think of the way farm animals are treated, and I'm not talking about on family farms. Family farms, there's
sure.
even when animals are grown for meat, the animals are usually treated very humanely. It's the agribusinesses I'm talking about, where the treatment of pigs to produce more pigs, to have the numbers that they have in those factories, it's incredibly inhumane. And pigs, it's said, I think it's sometimes hard to make these comparisons, but research has shown that they have the intelligence of a two-year-old human. So I don't know, you know, how they can put an age on that, but they've done research. And I when you think about the way they're being kept, to me this is horrendous. And so one of the things that I really, the reason why I did the Farm Animal Sanctuary is that I really want people to think about all species. And I'm talking about in the wild as well, that all beings on this earth deserve respectful treatment, and that we really need to reconsider our relationship to nature, in my view.
I just had an interesting idea. We're starting to run out of time, but just the thought, as I'm listening to you about the pigs, we talk about DNA, and we talk about, you know, the muscle memory and genetic memory and so on and so forth. And if you take those animals, and this just came up in my head right now, so this is not researched or anything, just a thought, that if you took those animals and you do what you do to them as those people do what they do to them, there's got to be fear within those animals. And when they die, there is fear. And that fear is locked up in those bodies. And when those bodies are recreated and put out for food, we eat that stuff.
I am so impressed that you're saying this, because it is one of, since I'm I do energy healing for animals, yeah. This is one of the areas that I talk to people about, because so many of us don't recognize how much of the world is energy. And, you know, Einstein said it, matter equals energy. So
sure.
where would that fear go? But actually, you can say it even more in terms of Western science, which is when the body has a stress reaction, which, of course, it would under fear, all this cortisol is released. Well,
yep.
you're eating cortisol when you eat that meat. So that can't be good for the human body. And I also don't think it's good for the planet to have that energy of fear and pain out there. I really think we ought to focus on trying to put out more positive energy, especially for the future of our planet. We're kind of in a mess here, and I really think that reestablishing that sense of connection between all beings and us and nature, everything, can really help us to turn around this terrible environmental situation that we've gotten ourselves into.
Yeah, Stephanie, I hate to do this because I could talk to you all night. We have run out of time. Website, we can find you in the book and all of the things you're doing.
Yeah, thank you. It's www.stephaniemarone.com. It's StephanieMarohn.com. And please also visit my blog, which you can find through the website.
Wonderful. And if that went by too fast, if anybody missed it, it'll be up on our website. Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael. Take care.
Take care. Good night.
Miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you know, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy, comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so good, you're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging, you're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, for you. Some of these days.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Tim Levy with us. He's the author of The Life Summit. Map out the life of your dreams in 6 easy steps. He's residing in Austin, Texas now. He's a successful author. He's a speaker. He's an entrepreneur. He's the creator, producer of the children's television series Groove Delicious, The Life Unlimited. He's a former creative director and corporate strategist whose clients include Sony, IBM, Hewlett-Packard, and the list goes on. Hey, Tim, welcome to the show.
Good day. Thank you very much for having me.
You know what I love about that? You've got a Texas accent. I can hear it.
It's very clear. It comes with the boots. I think they give that to you when you walk in the door around here.
You got it loud and clear. By the way, you obviously are from Australia. Coming in to live here, what's life like here compared to what it was at home?
Well, you know, there's something about the States that just makes me feel alive. I don't know. There's a really great entrepreneurial charge, especially in Austin, a very creative charge. So I love being here for that. It's very different than Australia because you got to think that there's a country, a landmass that's about the same size as North America, but there are only 20-odd million people in the whole place. So it's kind of empty. So I guess the big thing is the land and the people are different because there's far fewer of them. And, of course, there's the cowboy boots, which you already mentioned.
Sure. No, absolutely. No, got it loud and clear. But the 6 steps to having the life that you want, most people have no idea what it is they want. They have maybe a little bit of a feeling about what it could be, but they've never, quote-unquote, mapped it out. Somebody said something to me years ago, which I thought made all the sense in the world. If you project yourself out 15, 20 years from now, and you're at a party, and the party is, they're honoring you. And you write down everything you would like them to say about you. Now you got 15 to 20, 25 years to create those things. Now it becomes a roadmap. And that's what I think most people need in their own walk of life, a roadmap to how to get to what they want once they visualize or conceptualize what they want at the end of the road.
I really agree with you. And it's an interesting thing because exercises like that, and the Life Summit process has a lot in common with what you're talking about. It does this one particular thing, which is it gets people out of their own way. Because the question most people ask that stops them from really getting any clarity about their dreams and their passions and what's possible for them is they always start with the question, how? So they start by saying, listen, before I even admit to my dreams, before I even admit to my desires, let me figure out how. And the problem is that that's backwards. Because if, as you say, you start off with the what, that more right brain creative exercise of what would be awesome, then the how tends to present itself. All you have to do is get out of your own way long enough to get that written down.
Now, by the way, you're a teacher of metaphysical principles. Let's define what metaphysics is, and then we'll bring it into a practical, reachable concept that people can actually experience. When we talk about metaphysical principles, what are we dealing with?
All right, so for me, metaphysical means everything beyond the physical, everything that you cannot see. So most people are pretty familiar with the physical, you know, get up, go to work, do your job, get your paycheck, go home, but they're not so familiar with what's beyond that. So metaphysical for me is everything beyond that, and for a lot of people that starts to bleed into things that are a bit more spiritual, perhaps religious if they're more into organized religion, things that are beyond what you can see. That's what's metaphysical.
And somebody once said to me, they were talking about thinking outside the box. And there was a great definition of that because people always say, think outside the box. But what does that actually mean? Because when you boil it down, we all pretty much think the same thoughts. We mix them around a bit, but they come out about the same. But thinking outside the box means thinking thoughts you didn't think you could think. And I think that's where you tie in metaphysics. It goes beyond what you've been trained to think and allows you to open up to a world that's right in front of you, but it's been invisible.
Absolutely. I think that's a great way of putting it. And I heard some statistics that most people think something in the realm of 90-something percent of their thoughts the same from one day to the next. And then, amazingly, they expect that they're going to have a different day. So I help people break that maybe the other way around. And as you say, go beyond what they've been thinking into something that's completely fresh and new. And I think that's why this work is so inspirational, because people reconnect with these deep, almost hidden passions. And they're like, oh, man, is this possible? And that's what gets them out of bed in the morning. And then that actual thoughts themselves, in my experience, are in fact polarizing. It's kind of as if you were a magnet. So once you start thinking these thoughts, particularly in a consistent and unambiguous fashion, then these things start to present themselves. They start to show up. It's an amazing and kind of semi-magical kind of thing. And you can't explain it by sure. physical means alone.
Oh, absolutely. Let's put it in a different way. When you talk about, the book, The Secret and the Law of Attraction, most people think that, that's really not there. There's a lot of quote-unquote skepticism about it. But a very practical way to look at it is this way. What about the people who have absolute misery in their life? You know, they no matter what they do, they fail at. No matter what they do this, they do that. It's an unconscious thought, and you prove yourself right about yourself by making people reject you, making people leave you, and so on and so forth. And if people don't think that the law of attraction doesn't exist, take a look at your life, and if you got that kind of power to be miserable, what would happen if you shifted it and thought just a different way? It's the same dynamic with a different way to think.
Well, I completely agree. And with all the sort of the secret and the law of attraction, I think there was a very strong backlash, because in the end, I think it presented as if it was something that was simple and instant. And what I've noticed is that it all boils down to one sentence for me, which is that whatever you focus on consistently and unambiguously, which means without some kind of internal conflict, is what shows up. So as you say, if you took your 98% negative thoughts and made it into, so to speak, 98% creative, positive, imaginative thoughts, and you did that consistently, which is to say more than, once a year when you do your New Year's resolutions, and you were unambiguous, which is to say that you actually clearly believed what you were doing instead of having ambiguity, and that's when people have these big shifts and their lives change forever.
Yeah, and it was an interesting thing. Mark Victor Hansen was on, a couple of years ago, I interviewed him here on the show, and he had said that they had created the secret, but that they came to this conclusion that they didn't tell anybody how to do it, and they had to rewrite all the books and everything else for the second phase of it. And I think that's really where it is. Most people miss that practical, hold my hand, take me step by step, and show me how to do it, the left brain side of it. Show me how to do it, and then bring me to the door that will open up that creative right side brain of me.
This is exactly why I bothered to write out the Life Summit. It is, in fact, when I was pitching it to the publisher, the hook that I gave them was, this is the book you read after you've read The Secret. The Life Summit process is designed to be that more left-brain structure that becomes a way of life, becomes a mindset, and kind of forces you to do that consistency piece, that unambiguous piece that really makes this work in a grounded fashion. And so that's why I've been able to take it into, for example, the CEOs of big business. Because you got to believe, you got to understand that if I took this wishy-washy woo-woo stuff into, executive world, they'd throw you out. So the fact that I've managed to do that and do that, I'm speaking to executive groups pretty much every month right now across America, is because this has that more structured left brain process piece that I agree with you, I'm pretty sure was missing from that first time around.
Oh, absolutely. And when you talk about the law of attraction, what is the business going to want? They're going to want to increase their bottom line. And when it comes down to it, that's really what it is. And they take different directions to do it. But in the end result, that's what they're looking for. So how do you attract the bottom line, quote unquote, and then you move from there? Business has a language. Everything in and of itself, Tim, has its own language. And if you learn to speak the language of who it is that you're addressing at time and place, all of a sudden the world starts to turn around for you. And there is a universal language that's spoken but it's not a language. It's not a left brain, the verbal language. It's a language of imagery based on how we've learned to process and take things in. And if I can say things in a way that you've learned to recognize it, very important word, that you learn to recognize it, then all of a sudden we're on the same page. Most people speak a language and they don't take into consideration that the audience that they're dealing with, one person or 10 million, do not speak that same language.
Look, I completely agree. It's a funny thing you say, because I do get to speak to very different audiences. Sometimes I speak in church. Last week I spent an hour or two in front of a group of 200 unemployed people. Next week I'm in Denver in front of an executive-only group. And so I've got 3-4 different versions of the same talk just to change out the language in such a way that I use this phrase. I say that it's digestible. You know, it's like someone's lactose intolerant. Don't ask them to, you know, eat the wrong food. So it's the same thing with this language. You can't go into these places and expect them to dance to the same words. So, I think that's a amazing insight.
You know, when we really take a look at it, and it's all imagery, and it's all in the way, again, that you've learned to take in and perceive what things are. If I say to you, try this out. If I say to you, chamber a round, do you know what that means?
Well, as it happens, I do, because I'm in Texas, but probably before I wouldn't have.
Okay, and if most people out there don't know what that word is, if I said, you know, put a bullet in a gun, now all of a sudden you see it. That's the language I'm talking about. If you don't have an image for chamber around, or better yet, if I say Krasnaya Kharova, which are the only two words I know in Russian, if you don't speak Russian, you won't have an image for it. You don't have an image, you're not speaking the language. I think that's really where the key is. It's not that people don't understand. It's in the way that they've learned to receive it and the communication level.
Absolutely. And it's a funny thing you talk about imagery, because I do all of my work, especially, you know, when I'm speaking, when I'm working with people, I do everything in pictures. I do everything in mind mapping. I do everything. I've got to admit, I use a box of markers that, you know, in Australia are sold to 13-year-old girls because they're bright and colorful and
sure,
they get the point across. So at the end of the day with me, you wind up with 20, you know, 11 by 17 pages of imagery, because there's something about it. I mean, a picture says 1,000 words. There's something about it that gets through kind of beyond the words, beyond the eyes, and into the heart of the matter. So there's something about that as well, that imagery is really important for sort of getting that amazing clarity that is what everybody is striving for, because that's the seed. Clarity is everything. Before everything comes clarity.
Yeah, and by the way, it sets up an unconscious activation of something you've experienced before that now you recognize through the picture, the image, the rest of it. Neuromarketing, that's what major advertisers have been using for years. And when it really comes down to it, it triggers the recognition of what you're looking for. And I have said time and again that when I say you, Tim, I don't mean you, Tim, but you in the general sense of the word. You don't know what that benefit is, that key benefit that your audience, your consumer, your customer, whatever it is looking for. That doesn't mean that you don't have the solution for it, but in the end result, they're going to put their problem on your solution, and there may be things that you can fix with this that you hadn't even thought about.
Absolutely, and it's been quite amazing. I've been doing this work with people for a little while, and you understand I came out of business, and a lot of my clients were in big business, well-known brands. And so I thought when I was doing this work, I'd be helping people to achieve primarily business goals. So I figured, you know, like I've done books and stage shows and TV shows and sure, business development, you know, multiplying businesses. I figured that's what this would be about. What's amazing to me is I've helped people in a very holistic fashion. You know, this clarity work is amazing. It's helped people get off medication. It's helped people absolutely transform relationships. It's helped people in physical senses as well as business and everything else. So it's amazing how broadly holistic this thing works. Once you get this mindset, it works pretty much across a life. And I've yet to find a place where it doesn't create that change.
Wonderful. By the way, Tim, I could talk to you about this all night, but we are starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this. Before we do, let me leave you with this. I'll put a smile on your face. I got to give you my impression of Texas, which I'll never forget.
Okay.
June 18th, 1960, I graduated high school. June 21st, 1960, I was in San Diego at the Marine Corps Recruit Depot, and I was starting to go through boot camp. most of the guys I went through with at the time happened to have been from Texas, Port Arthur, Orange, and that area. And one day I was making fun of Texans. I ended up in the dumpster. And from that day forward, I have had a respect for Texans. You'll never Tim, can we get your website and where to buy the book at?
Absolutely. And, you know, it would be terrific if people came and visited me at timlevy.net. That's TimLevy.net. And also, as a fun thing, there's actually a free little book that you can get if you come right to the front page there called Three Steps to a Perfect Life. It's just a little teaser, a little taste of the sort of work that I do with people, and it'd be delightful if people came on board and grabbed themselves a free copy.
Wonderful. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Good night.
And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Well, that's all. Well, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Well, that's all. Well, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Kimberly Pryor with us. She's the author of The Indestructible Relationship, Support, Understand Each Other Better During Grief, Illness, Catastrophic Loss, and All Life's Stressful Moments. She's a freelance journalist who has had more than 600 articles published in magazines and newspapers, including Alaska Airlines Magazine, Sacramento Magazine, the San Jose Mercury News, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and Mountain Living. And let us say, Kim, I welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael.
By the way, Kim, and thank you so much for being here. I think one of the biggest problems that people face today, it's not business, it's not the economy, it's called keeping a relationship together. And I think it's getting harder and harder all the time with those massive, you know, the statistics with the 50-some-odd percent divorce, divorce rate in the first relationship, and it goes on from there. What do we do to make sure that we, quote-unquote, bulletproof, divorce-proof the relationship?
Well, one of the things I'd like to address, too, is that with the economy being the way it is and so many couples being under financial stress, you know, that is, you're right, that's putting people under stress more so today than ever before. So, you know, I think that these days marriages, relationships in general are facing a lot more stress than people did in the 1950s or so. So, you know, there are so many things that people can do to stop stress from affecting their relationship. It's such a factor, you know, it's really as big of a factor in relationships as another man or another woman. It can be that damaging. When people are under stress, they're simply not, they're not nice to each other. So there are different ways that, you know, we can stop each other from being hurtful to each other when we're under stress. And, I'd definitely love to share with you some of those today.
Well, sure. Now, by the way, when as we do this, some of the couples that you've worked with, obviously, you talk about stress-proofing a relationship. That most people would have no idea how you could do that, because it just seems to be part and parcel of what you sign up for. It doesn't have to be, but that's what it is. It's that inability to relate to each other. I think things are a certain way. You think things are another way. And together we clash. So how do you keep that balance going?
Well, you know, a lot of it is just making a commitment to do so. And, you know, there are certain techniques that can be used. And a lot of the couples that I interviewed in the book, they've gone through the most stressful experiences anyone can imagine. And yet they had certain techniques that they used for keeping their relationship strong, even under stress. You know, they went through those same issues, like you said. You know, people see things different ways. And, you know, that is a very good point. And they have certain techniques. And, you know, I'll definitely get into some of those. You know,
sure.
If you're ready for some of them right now, I'll address some of them.
Let me give you one great male stress reliever. Okay, you ready for this one?
Sure. That'd be awesome.
I have something called Barney the Beat-Up Bag. But you know what those heavy bags?
What about?
The heavy bags look like, you know, the boxers use, the big ones.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. I have one down here by the studio. And when I get stressed out, I put the gloves on. Barney says, "Hey, Dad, I'm glad you're here." Barney's job is to get hit. He loves getting hit. If I don't hit him, something's wrong. So when I get stressed, that's how I take it out. And most of it has got to be physical, especially with the guys.
Yeah.
Get rid of
such an excellent point. That is such an excellent point, because one of the couples in my book, the one who had a child die, the woman, when she found the wife, when she found out that Danny had died, you know, she was crying and emotional. But the husband, what he did, he actually took his fist and slammed it into the bedroom door and dented the door.
Yeah.
So, yes, men do tend to take out stress more physically. They react to it more physically, and, you know, that can be a good stress reliever for a man, is finding, you know, participating in sports, you know, can accomplish that just as well, too.
I learned this years ago. I had horses for years, but I had a horse that if you would put a saddle on him, he'd go up, over, rear up, and go up, over, and he would go down. And it was called Cinch Bound. And there was a trainer about a half mile away from me. So I would go over to her place, and she would put me in something called a round pen. In the round pen, you had the horse on a rope, and you had this little whip, and you didn't necessarily hit the horse, but you cracked it, and the horse ran in circles, and you had to chase the horse. Well, I got to tell you, when it really came down to it, Kim, I got so tired chasing the horse that the fear and the stress and everything else left. So sometimes physically is one of the best stress relievers that there are, because you take it out on something else, and at the same time, it's not hurting anybody, and it's constructive.
That's very true. And in fact, that works for women, too. Exercise is an incredible stress reliever for women as well. You know, I'll climb a mountain to de-stress, because when you're focusing on getting to the top of that mountain, that's the only thing you're focusing on. You tend to think you don't forget about you forget about deadlines, you forget about, you know, everything else is going on. It's your one goal, is to get to the top of that mountain. So for both men and women, I think that's a good stress reliever.
Yeah, but you forget about this stress that comes with that when you get up to the top and you look down.
That's
you
true.
Say, I get here, and how am I going to get down? But that's good.
That's true. That is true. But it is very good for the body and the soul as well.
Okay, by the way, what got you into this? What was it that caused you to first put this to pen?
Well, you know, a number of years ago, a lot of my friends were getting divorced. And, you know, I wasn't having a ton of luck back then either with relationships. And I was kind of curious to know, well, I was watching the news, and I saw couples who had gone through some natural disasters, floods, and I wanted to know, well, you know, if my friends' relationships are falling apart, two or three of them, and they didn't go through anything horribly stressful, and yet their relationships are falling apart, what is it that makes relationships stay together when people are going through stressful experiences, whether it's bankruptcy, cancer, chronic illness, the death of a child, a natural disaster? I mean, what was it that, you know, kept their relationships together through these really stressful times?
And by the way, did you find an overarching theme, something that seemed to move through all of the different stories, all the different examples? Did you find a theme that worked for everybody?
Well, you know, really, I found, I would guess about 45 different ways that things that people had in common, things that these couples had in common that they all did, the indestructible couples, what they did to keep their relationships alive during stressful times. They all had, I would say, around 45 different things in common. You know, things like complimenting each other during stressful times instead of being critical. Because we tend to use each other really as an emotional punching bag a lot of times. We think that because we're close to someone that gives us the right to be kind of mean to them when we're under stress. But in reality, you know, I mean, we actually are nicer to our neighbors than our romantic partners a lot of times.
Sure.
So one of the commonalities was a lot of the couples, actually all the couples in the book, were very complimentary toward each other. They, you know, said good things about each other. A couple that I interviewed that had gone through a natural disaster, a flood up in North Dakota, you could actually hear the pride in their voice when they talked about the way that each of them handled the flood. They were not in the least bit critical of each other. So that was one thing that was in common, was just being complimentary of each other.
Yeah. And by the way, it's called acknowledging, accepting, and I think that's extremely important. Now let's reverse it. Did you find one common theme that drove everybody apart?
Yes. And actually, there was probably a handful of those, but really one of the biggest ones was blame. You know, blame is so toxic to relationships, and, you know, it can emerge in so many different ways. I mean, let's say you're having financial problems, and you're the one doing the finances and balancing the checkbook. If your significant other blames you for the financial problems because you were the one doing the finances, that is, you know, very bad for the relationship. It's much better to actually sit down and ask each other, what can we both do differently in order to solve our financial problems, rather than blaming. You know, the couples, I actually did a comparison between the couples who'd made it, and I also interviewed couples who didn't make it. And one of the things that came up was the woman who had, I interviewed two women who had cancer. One of them, her husband was very supportive and basically said, you can, you know, handle this any way you want. I'll let you decide. You go ahead and decide how you want to get treated. You know, I don't want to have any input because I think it's your decision. And, you know, if you want my advice, great. But there was another couple that broke up, and her husband was very insistent that she handle the cancer his way. He wanted her to, like, you know, do more yoga, do more alternative things, but that was not important to her. And so he basically blamed her because she did not want to handle the cancer in his way. She did not want to treat it in whatever way he dictated. So that's how blame can show up in relationships, and that was one of the commonalities of the couples who had made it, is they didn't blame each other for things. They took responsibility for their own actions.
You know, Kim, when it comes down to, I'm fighting with a black cat here, so you have to excuse me. She thinks it's her microphone, and it's not. Go away, cat. If you hear these strange sounds, it's her purring into the microphone. But anyway, what I have found over all these years, that with an author, fact, fun, fiction, fantasy, whatever the case may be, when you decide to put something to pen, there is that moment there's this cathartic moment. There is this moment when you're into it and you begin to realize a dimension of the subject matter that you were not aware of. Where was that for you in this? Because this, with relationships, it would have to be a very special moment.
That's an interesting question. A dimension, you mean something, a fact that may have surprised me or something that I didn't expect? Is that
something you didn't
to?
Expect, something you weren't aware of, something that all of a sudden you learned something that you didn't even realize existed.
Well, you know, I think a lot of it for me, as far as what you talked about as being kind of a catharsis type of thing, this whole book for me was that way, because it's what I did with the book is I told stories. I thought it was important to not just give people advice in the book, but let people get to know the couples, basically, so they understood what the couples were going through. So for me, it was artistic expression as well, because it wasn't just, you know, telling people advice. It was also recreating drama. I mean, you know, I recreated what the first couple in my book is a man who became paralyzed a month after the wedding. And they've been married 40 years now, but, you know, this poor young couple, this man became paralyzed, and it was such a moving story that to learn, to listen to the couple's talk, you know, was very moving. And I think it really inspired me. It really inspired me because one of the things that came through in the book, you asked about common themes, was everybody in this book, no matter how bad of an experience they went through, said one of the ways they got through it was to realize that other people had it worse. And I think that surprised me that even, for instance, the couple that had lost a child told me that, you know, we feel worse for other couples who have lost a child because our child did not die violently. You know, their child died of a heart attack, which to me is just, you know, I mean, that's horrible. But they actually said that they knew someone who had lost all three of their children. And so they really tried to think of other people as having it worse. So I think that really surprised me, as some of the couples had gone through such horrible experiences and yet could still empathize with other people and realize that they're, you know, they use that as a stress reduction technique, really, is to realize that other people did have it much worse.
And after all of the research, all of the study, putting the book together, the rest of it, do you look at relationships completely different now?
You know, I think I do. I really do. I think that after looking at some of the things all these couples have gone through, it comes down to, you know, if I'm having a bad day or if there's something small that happens between my boyfriend and me, it really doesn't matter, because I think of the big things that these couples have gone through. And I think, you know, these little things don't really matter. The important thing is that you love each other. And the little things don't matter in life. It's the big things that, you know, really matter more. But, you know, if you're willing to work at it, use the techniques that are in the book. And really, they're very easy techniques, things that are fun to implement. If you do that, then, you know, it's easy to get along. You know, it's easier to get along.
Sure. That makes sense. We're about out of time. Kim, let me ask you this. Is there a website we can find you at, get the book, and get more information?
Yes. Go ahead and visit me at www.indestructiblerelationship.com. And I also have a free newsletter there that people can subscribe to with stress reduction tips for couples. You can also buy the book on Amazon. If you have any sort of electronic device, you can buy the book. If you just go to my website, it's available on the Nook, the Kindle, you know, your iPad, your iPhone, your computer, for that matter. So that would be where people would go.
Wonderful. Kim, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Michael. I appreciate it.
Take care. Good night.
And the only night.
For you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand of holding leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore from now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, yeah, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
And a hand that I can hold to feel you near as I grow old.
Russ Wallace Withers, he's the author of Zenobia, A Birth of a Legend, Historical Fiction. He's a lifelong student of history, religion, politics, social issues, is an instructor, and he came to value the critical thinking so necessary to navigate minefields of propaganda while searching for truth. Russ remains convinced that every individual who learns to think analytically benefits his or own person, his family, his community, his country, and the world, the worldwide human society. Thus, a principal goal of the book, Russ writes, is to stimulate something called reasoning. Hey, Russ, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Nice to be with you.
Thank you so much for being here. Reasoning, Russ, that's something that I wonder if most people have the ability to do anymore, only because of this mass amount of information, numbing information that we get constantly. I mean, there's thousands and thousands of bits of information that every one of us hears, and it gets to a point where it gets confusing, and to look through all of the rhetoric to get down to logic and some reasoning, sometimes in this day and age, can be very hard.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, it's over-information has been a problem, but the misinformation and propaganda is, in my mind, perhaps an even bigger problem. And then a lot of things involving thinking can be improved with proper training. One of the problems is, and I've discussed this with some educators, as one educator told me, I can assure you, she said, that there's there is no critical thinking that's taught in the school systems. They have a format for teaching, and they have routine answers that are given, and people aren't taught to evaluate the content of the things they're hearing.
Absolutely, and I'm going to go back to 100 years ago when I was in high school. We were given, let's say, a math problem. You know, all right, 3 plus 2 plus 2 plus 5 is something. How did you arrive at that? How did you get to that? And it would be the critical thinking to go back and break it down and come up with the foundation of what caused the answer that you came up with. That doesn't happen anymore. You're so spot on with that. Critical thinking is something almost of the past.
Yeah, I'm afraid that that's true for large segments of society. Now, there are a lot of critical thinkers in our society, but they're certainly a minority, and a lot of them have simply overcome the inertia that the educational system has perhaps imposed on them. So while the book about Zenobia, actually it's the first of a series, I plan at least 7 in the series, and she was a real person, one of the most dynamic women who ever lived, but she had to have been a critical thinker to develop some of the things she did. Of course, she had to buck the tide of her day because she was a woman, and there was gender oppression, and women were generally not thought of as being very competent in the arenas that usually fall to men. In her case, of course, she became a political and a military genius, the like of which the world had never seen in a woman. And amazingly enough, she came to control, finally, the second most powerful army in the world, or at least in the Western world, and she got into a war with Rome. And she came close to overthrowing the Roman Empire. There's a lot of factors that worked against her, including betrayal by some of her allies, but some people who studied it feel that she actually could have overthrown Rome if she hadn't been betrayed by her allies. So just a dynamic woman. Well, so it's an adventure story. However, I put quite a bit about education in the book because Zenobia learns to think. She learns to to challenge a lot of the ideas that she's presented with, and she, and I think it's, of course, it's a book that targets young adults, although I think just about anybody might find it to be a fascinating story.
Well, by the way, when we talk about the logic, et cetera, let me bring you to something practical. And I watched this very interesting. There's a local market that they usually go into, and there was a kid behind the counter, and I think I gave her a $20 bill. I can't remember how much the change was, but I remember she had trouble counting it back, and she had to call somebody else over for help. And they had a couple of people there. They finally got it figured out. But in and of itself, Russ, that's critical thinking. She could not figure out how to get to that end result of how much money she subtract from the $20 bill. That's what's missing. That's exactly what you were saying. They don't have to think about it. They got the calculator, they've got the computer, and it's not necessary in their heads anymore.
Yeah, I agree with that. I've seen the clerks too at the register get the calculator out and have to use it in order to figure out a discount or a coupon that's not scanning, and they have to take it off. They use the calculator to do it. But, of course, that's a symptom, but it's kind of trivial compared to people not being able to evaluate, for example, whether they should get into a romantic relationship with some guy. I mean, this has the potential to affect a lot more than the pocket change in their purse. This has the potential to affect their life dramatically down the road.
But Russ, isn't the process the same? Critical thinking.
Yeah, I think it's somewhat the same, but mathematics is comparatively simple.
Well, yeah, that's true too. Okay, yeah, I'll bend on that one. But the point is, and I think the point you're making, and most people should be concerned about this, is that how do you come to, rhetorically, how do you come to a conclusion? What brings you to this conclusion? Just because you're confronted with it and you give ABC conclusion doesn't mean necessarily that that's going to be the true conclusion and or the truth to get you where you want to go. So really, that's what we're dealing with.
Almost inevitably, in my opinion, you have to be exposed to conflicting ideas to develop critical thinking. Now, for example, in the case of Zenobia in her book, and when she gets up toward 15, and a lot of girls were married before that, they got married around 13, so I might even have that a little later than it actually happened. But she gets into a discussion with her mother and her uncle because she wants to, what we would call, date a young warrior from her own tribe, and they don't think that this is the guy for her. And she's kind of upset with this, so they get into a discussion about this, and she tries to listen to their counsel and to think about their counsel. But, of course, it's not easy because her emotions are involved, and there's an attraction there, which when she was younger, she never anticipated such a thing, but now she's got this romantic attraction, and that colors things. And so this is an example where critical thinking, if you can get some people who are more experienced, then at least you can try to think about what they're telling you. Not that every teenager is going to agree with them or everybody's going to agree on anything, you know, like the Democrats or Republicans, which approach is better. But if you can objectively try to look at things, at least you can analyze, then you've got a better shot at getting it right.
You know, this brings up something you had mentioned that she was moving forward, and there were people that were with her that backed off on her I'm trying to remember what you said. We get older; it happens to us. So bear with me.
Yeah, me too. Well, they give her some counsel. And this happens in a lot of areas, not just on romance, but it happens in some other areas, too. She wants to become a general in her
Yeah, I think
uncle.
This was with the war, and the people that were supporting her backed off. You said something
wrong. Well, her allies betrayed her.
There you go. Okay, her allies betrayed her. No.
Yeah, that comes later on. That's not actually in book one, but this actually happens once she gets into the war with Rome. But of course,
let's look at critical thinking. Let's apply critical thinking to that. Did the Allies think it out? Did, you know, was it rhetorical questions? Did the Allies think it out? Did they learn? Did they learn what they learned about women, who women are, and not to follow women? Did they learn certain things that caused them to be stuck in a mindset or a position whereby, if they would have critically thought about it and could forecast the end result, they may not have backed away from her?
That's, I think you're right about that, and there's no question that a gender bias can play a role in those things, and not only that, but an ethnic bias and just the fear. Rome was the fiercest and deadliest world empire that had ever existed, and so to go up against Rome and support Zenobia's side of that conflict, that was maybe a greater risk than some of them wanted to take. They just figured they'd back the one who had been decided had been the winner in so many other conflicts. So who knows exactly? I mean, history doesn't tell us as much as I would really like to know about all that. So, and some of that particular part of the book, a future book, I haven't worked out yet either, but it's a problem in our society, the lack of critical thinking. I think, you know, you and I could give hundreds of examples of that, actually, but it's a shame.
Yeah, I mean, no, absolutely. Now, why a female heroine? Why following Zenobia? What was it about Zenobia that was special, that should stand out in history, that we should take a look at, that people in her era didn't look at, and because of it, missed out?
Well, of course, a lot of them did look at it. She was a charismatic leader, but this all happened gradually. It started out that when she was born, the sheik had an order out to kill all the baby girls. He didn't want any more daughters. So her mother wasn't having any of that nonsense, that lunacy, actually, and so her mother masqueraded Zenobia as a boy to save her life. Now, eventually, her gender's discovered, but by the time they discover her true gender, she is manifesting deadly warrior skills that the tribe values, and so the tribal leaders, instead of killing her, they decide to train her as a warrior, and she grows up to be a deadly warrior. Well, she was, as I say, a desert tribe. However, there's an oasis city in Syria. This was ancient Syria. The Roman province of Syria in those days was a lot bigger than modern Syria. And there's a lone oasis on key trade routes through the desert, which was a shortcut. And that was called Tadmor. And she eventually marries the senator from Tadmor, who is also the chief of the army. And so they engage in a lot of battles together. And gradually, she becomes the military strategist for these battles. And this was apparently known to only an inner circle of the Tadmorites. And so Rome didn't realize what was going on. Rome later on makes a critical mistake because of that. Rome didn't like powerful women, by the way, and there were no women who were empresses in the history of Rome. So anyway, what Zenobia is such a captivating character because she was a knockout beauty. She spoke five languages. She marched with the troops on foot. She could drink with the guys. And then she turns out to be this political and military genius, very interested in justice, issues of justice, certain questions of religion. She got into conflict over these things, had some difficulties. And she wanted to overthrow Rome. In my opinion, and there's, of course, a lot of controversy about that, even in the history of the eras in which she lived, but she felt that Rome was oppressing the world at that time, and she wanted to fix that. I mean, it, just an incredible story. If it were pure fiction, you know, a character like this, you'd think you went overboard on it. When I first started reading about her, I could hardly believe it.
By the way, Russell, now, but I've got it loud and clear. It does sound absolutely fascinating. The problem is I was listening so intently to you, we ran out of time. So let me ask you this.
I've got plenty of time.
But is there a website we can find you at, buy the book, and get more information?
Yeah, if you go to Geode Press, Geode, that's G-E-O-D-E, press.com, anyone can read some sample chapters of the book there. The book is Zenobia, Birth of a Legend, by Russ Wallace. You can get it at Amazon.com. If you want the e-books, you can get those from Smashwords.com, which is a large reseller of e-books in all the various formats, or you can get the Kindle format from Amazon as well, or you can order it through bookstores.
Wonderful. Hey, Russ, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I appreciate it. What a great story.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me, Michael.
Take care. Good night.
Night.
Off comes the makeup, off comes the clown's disguise, the curtain's falling, the music softly dies.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is a wrap.
You're smiling as you're filing out the door, as they say in this biz, that's all there is, there isn't any more. We've shared a moment. And as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling.